God, show me the way, because the devil's trying to break me down. The only thing that I pray is that my feet don't fail me now. And I don't think there's nothing I could do now to right my wrongs. I want to talk to God, but I'm afraid because we ain't spoken so long.
Kanye West gets the first word on the Brian Lehrer Show today. As they begin the Boston Marathon this morning for the first time since the bombing, what kind of story is this for Cardinal Timothy Dolan?
It's an Easter story, if you want to talk about it. It's a Passover story. Boston has risen up from carnage, from death, from darkness, to the most nauseating type of attack on a civilized society and an event that brings people together. They've risen from that. And the victims of that, their families, the whole Boston community, has reminded us once again of the message of Easter. Life is stronger than death. Hope is stronger than despair. And we're not going to let this evil, destroy us. Life goes on, and probably stronger and grittier than before because we've come through that darkness.
New York's Cardinal Timothy Dolan yesterday on Face the Nation. And with that, we begin a two-day special on The Brian Lehrer Show. Good morning, everyone. We have back-to-back family meetings on heaven and earth. Tomorrow, for the 40th annual Earth Day, it's Ask a Climatologist. No politics, no false equivalencies, just the actual science of climate change driven by your questions. That's for tomorrow, a Brian Lehrer Show Earth Day family meeting. But for today, for Easter Monday and the last full day of Passover, let's talk about your God, your faith, your practice, your place in the world as you take stock of it or took stock of it on two of the world's most mystical and political holidays. You don't usually get mystical and political together, right? But arguably on both Easter and Passover, and maybe for the Boston Marathon today, you do. Non-Jews, non-Christians, you're also welcome to join in on the ideas that we'll discuss and the stories that we'll share. Our special guests today include some names you may well know: Karen Armstrong, Krista Tippett, Jesuit Father James Martin, sometimes known as Colbert's priest. We'll see if he's moving to CBS too. But as these twin holy weeks end, if you take them seriously, what do these holidays really mean? 212-433-WNYC. Leave the hollow chocolate bunnies and marshmallow peeps aside. Stash the macaroons and the chocolate-covered matzah. And tell us the real bottom line for you. What do these holidays really mean, especially if you have spent time in prayer or reflection or anything like that over the last week? Go as deep as you possibly can. 212-433-9692. Here's a little more of what it means for Cardinal Dolan, as he put it on Face the Nation, as the mystical and the political came together for him.
What are you covering on this show? You're going to talk about Ukraine. We're going to recall the slaughter in Boston a year ago. You look at all the darkness, the dreariness, the reasons to be sad and defeated in the world today. And what does Holy Week and Easter talk about? What is Passover talking about? The victory of good over evil, light over darkness, life over death. We believe, Jews and Christians, believers, hold fast to the truth that God has the last word.
So, Christians, is that the Easter story as you see it, as you experience it in 2014? Good over evil, life over death, hope over despair. 212-433-9692. Christians and Jews, what's the bottom line for you as these holy weeks end? If they're as sacred as all that, what have you learned about your God or your world or yourself that really actually matters in this world? To Boston, to Ukraine, to New York, to New Jersey, say it out loud. How does the crucifixion, the resurrection, the betrayal of Jesus, or the parting of the Red Sea, the flight from slavery in Egypt, the plagues, Moses not being allowed to reach the Holy Land, mean to the world in 2014? 212-433-9692. And just to up the spiritual ante here, I'll also ask you when you call in, if you believe in God, how do you picture God? And tell us what happens when you pray. If you're Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, and we'll have a Hindu guest, a Buddhist guest, a Muslim guest later on, or anything else, what actually happens when you pray to God? Two more questions on the table to begin this family meeting on Easter and Passover and God on the Brian Lehrer Show. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. What is or was the bottom line for you over the last week? And if you believe in God, tell us how you picture God and what happens when you pray. 212-433-9692. Carol in Lyndhurst, you want to start us off? Hi, Carol.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just think that Easter for me is not just a one-day-a-year event. It's an everyday affair, having a personal relationship with my Creator and realizing the sacrifice that He made for me as an individual to come into this world and to save us from our own sin, and to be able to recognize that on a personal level, it really gives us overcoming power in our everyday trials. So for me, it's a way of life.
It's a way of life. It gives you power over your everyday trials. Does that just mean to face your own adversities, whatever they may be, or is it also to live in the world as a certain kind of person?
I believe it's our worst enemy is ourselves. And when we can recognize that through the blood that was shed on Calvary, then we can truly experience a free, a life full of liberty and of love towards mankind.
What do you picture when you picture God, if you picture anything?
You mean physically speaking, what do I see?
If you see anything.
Or spiritually.
Either way.
I see. He came in the form of man, and Jesus, that's who I see.
And what happens when you pray?
My burdens are lifted.
Carol,
I really feel I have a communion with him, and he hears me.
Thank you very much for starting us off. Judith on the Upper West Side. You're on WNYC. Hi, Judith.
Hi, good Yom Tovim.
And to you. So start us off at the deepest possible level of what your Passover, your Yom Tov means to you.
First of all, my God is the creator of and the regulator of nature and the healer of wounds. He is not the God that's written about in the Bible that says, go get in this village, kill everybody, and take it for the Hebrews. The Bible was written by a real estate mogul. So I celebrate Passover by having a reading of the Song of Songs, which is the Sephardim read the Song of Songs after the Seder. But I decided to make my whole Seder around the reading of the Song of Songs.
Certain
of course,
lines,
we eat
certain
the
lines.
And all that stuff.
Right. But certain lines from the Song of Songs that.
Beg your pardon?
Certain lines from the Song of Songs that stick out to you that.
Oh, the voice of the turtle shall be heard throughout the land. It's
the turtle, representing?
Springtime, the mating of the turtles. It's springtime.
Renewal, universal renewal?
Yeah, it's springtime, yeah.
What do you mean the Bible was written by a real estate mogul?
Well, they have God ordering the Hebrews to go in the village and kill everybody and take it from the Canaanites for themselves, and they have them just going from one place to another and doing that, and that's why I think it was written by a real estate mogul. It's not divine.
The book of gentrification. Judith, thank you very much. Louise in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Good morning, Brian.
What do you celebrate?
I celebrate Easter, and I'm a Christian. I spend the time of Holy Week reviewing the Gospels leading up to the Last Supper and the crucifixion, and I do a study, basically, of how Jesus is the fulfillment of the prophecies of the Old Testament, because that's what he said he was. And I want to examine that and study it, and it reaffirms in me what I believe. And I try to do this every year around this time.
Any prophecies in particular?
Well, if you study the book of Isaiah, there's a very incredible, although for me very believable, description of the person who would be the sacrifice for the nations. And Jesus is the fulfillment of that, even to the point where lots were cast for his garments.
And to what end?
I'm sorry?
To what end? To what end in the world? How does it change your behavior? How does it make you a better person or the world a better place that you believe that?
It totally changed me. When I moved from Catholicism, I was raised as a Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
As an adult, I chose Christianity because I was seeking more than what I was able to find as a practicing Catholic.
A more evangelical Christianity, is that the right way to put it?
I don't really label it. I am just constantly seeking. I do attend a church that I believe calls itself Pentecostal.
Mm-hmm.
But
so would you consider?
It's not so much about church for me. It's about seeking truth. I do attend church. I'm not trying to say that I don't.
Mm-hmm.
But I question and I seek and I feel that it's my responsibility.
A personal relationship with God?
Absolutely. And it did change my life. It definitely changed the way the work, my attitude about my work, about the people that I deal with on a daily basis, the way I see them. And, you know, Brian, you had asked about our image of God. How do we see God when we pray? And I literally just closed my Bible moments before I turned the radio on and had my prayer time. And I see God as Jesus. Jesus said, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. And that's all I have to go by.
Louise, thank you so much. And Alan in Butler, New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay.
I have a funny way about feeling about religion. I mean, there are times when I feel very interested in it and feel very sincere that I believe in the God and I believe in Jesus and all. But there are times when I look back and say to myself, you know, if there was a God, if religion really meant something to everyone, I don't understand the hatred that boils over from all the religions against each other and all the people that have actually died because of religion.
So keep this personal. How does that perception of the place of religion in history, the place of religion in the world today, affect your own faith, if that's the right word, practice, if that's the right word, your relationship with a God, if that's the right word, that it seems like you believe in on some level?
I have faith, and I do believe that, you know, there is a God. I do believe that, you know, we should have something. We should look up to something that has some meaning that would give you some way of understanding not to do evil things. But when I look at the 9/11 thing, that's where I lose a lot of my faith, because I see these people on a plane, innocent people that did nothing to these people that we call terrorists. Although we call them terrorists, they call themselves religious fanatics or whatever. They are fanatics. And, you know, they're sitting on a plane looking at all these innocent people and crashing it into a building, and all over religion. And I get to the point where I lose that faith and that belief, because I say, why can't we all just get along together, you know, and respect each other's beliefs and how we feel about our religion and not, you know, trample on somebody else's, you know, beliefs in religion.
So, Alan, on a scale of 1 to 10, from ultimately kind to totally malicious, how would you rate God?
I rate God to ultimately kind, and I don't blame him for what people do. Because if you look at the Crusades, I believe that there was a total misconception as to what it meant. I mean, we went over there to destroy the Muslims. The Muslims wanted to destroy us for invading their land, and we did invade their land. I don't blame him for it. I think man himself has a misconception of what religion really means.
Alan, thank you very much. Tom in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tom.
Hi. So would you like to know my personal relationship to these days?
Absolutely.
Well, it's a way of reconnecting myself or connecting myself most strongly to the part of human experience that isn't based on facts. but is more based on truth.
Ooh, you're making a distinction between fact and truth.
Yes, it's the same distinction as between poetry and prose. It's the same distinction between myth and history. But it's part of who we are as people, and if we confuse those things, we get into serious trouble. And part of the problem of the modern world is that we don't make a place for the kind of truth, the kind of experience that connects us with the universe in a spiritual and holy way.
When you say experience, what happens when you pray?
Well, many things happen when I pray, because prayer is a very active activity. But it brings me closer to the love that is at the center of the universe. If I pray for strength, often I get strength, which is a wonderful thing.
That's the result of prayer. But what happens when you pray? You say it's active.
Oh, okay.
Active.
All right.
How?
Okay. So I speak to an image of God, but it's a human image. I don't think that I'm on the telephone. I have my own personal human image. In the way that looking at an icon, you look at an image of something that's inexpressible. So I speak to God. I speak to God if I'm praying through Mary, or if I'm praying through Jesus, or mm-hmm. if I'm just praying to the universe. I speak to God, but it's my own kind of personal, limited human concept of mm-hmm. who God mm-hmm. is.
So let me ask you one more thing.
But it represents God to me.
If you've become richer or poorer during your life, has God
absolutely nothing to do with it?
Taken on different meanings for you in those different conditions in your life?
No, not God, no.
No.
No, but prayer and the act of religion has, for sure.
In what ways?
Well, you know, in times of sorrow, in times of grief, one becomes closer to one's need for support, you know? And in times of joy and in times of celebration, one becomes close to the part of prayer and the part of faith that it involves thanksgiving. So those are two. I mean, they're very allied, but they're two relatively separate things.
Tom, thank you, thank you very much. All right, let's do one more here, and we're going to bring on Karen Armstrong in a minute. Claire in Hoboken, you're on WNYC. Hi, Claire.
Hello. So I was sort of a fallen Catholic, and I was a teacher. I'm a teacher, and I joined a school in New York City that's a Catholic school, and it had this very beautiful theology that I was attracted to, although I had no faith. I wasn't really practicing at all. And then shortly thereafter, my mother became, I had to take my mother to church. She was unable to go on her own. And the church we went to had also this beautiful theology of God as a loving God who's very accepting. And then right after that, I started praying every day. And I used this website, Sacred Space, that is established by these Irish Jesuits. And the praying every day completely transformed my life. And I became so present to that my Creator loves me and just how precious I am. And somehow I would pray in the morning and I would leave to go to work and I would bring this experience of love to my day. And it completely transformed my experience with my students, with my colleagues. I felt so appreciative of just like what a great life I had and how much I am loved. And
so there are two things there that are almost contradictory. How precious I am, you are.
Yes.
And the love that you bring to others as a result, rather than how small I am, how humble I am, and therefore the love that you bring to others.
Well, I guess so. I mean, I do feel very humble. I do feel humility, but I also feel, you know, it's like when you create something, you love it because you've created it. It's very precious to you. And I do feel when I'm praying that I'm very valuable, you know, to God.
Is it a different feeling? Is it a different feeling now that you're with the Irish Jesuits than what you had when you prayed in the earlier Catholic part of your life before you lapsed?
Absolutely.
How?
In my early part of my life, because I went to 12 years of Catholic school, uh-huh. I had the experience that God had a plan for me, whether I liked it or not. It had nothing to do with my own inner world. and that I had to submit to it and conform to it. And I was very resistant to that. And my parents were very spiritual people, but Catholics are not very, I think we are not very open about our faith. And I didn't understand. I envied them their faith, but I didn't understand it.
Claire, thank you so much for your call. I really, really appreciate it. And let's bring Karen Armstrong into this conversation, the renowned religious scholar, author of many books, including A History of God, The Battle for God, and A Case for God. She is also a former nun who is now a Muslim and creator of a
–
are you not?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I had read that. Forgive me, Karen. Forgive me. And creator of a document and a movement she calls the Charter for Compassion. You are that, right?
Yes, indeed.
And it's always enlightening to talk to you. Thank you for joining us today.
It's a great pleasure.
And we've just been taking calls, maybe you've heard the last few, on how people picture God and what happens when they pray. When you think of God, do you have an image of any kind in your head?
No, I don't. I take quite care not to have an image of God in my mind, because I think God goes beyond any kind of imagery or any kind of thought that we have or any kind of words that we use, really. And there's always it's always important to keep that sense of distinction between what I think about of God and the indescribable reality itself, because otherwise it's quite easy to make up a God in your own image and likeness.
So if God is that beyond anything, what does God mean to you? Is God the judge and the boss? Is God just love? Is God morally neutral? What is this God you keep putting in the title of your books?
Well, what I'm trying to say is that God, as we understand it, and this has been in all three of the monotheistic religions which center on the idea of God, there's always been this very strong tradition reminding us that what we think about God has no bearing on the absolute reality itself. Most theology has been about this until the modern period, when we started being a bit more confident that we could say exactly what God is. And that's made God incredible. God is transcendence. There is in human life always. There's always been this sense that there's something that always eludes us about the world. A sense of wonder and awe and majesty that we see it in the world about us and in other people too. It's important not to tie God down too much to a particular image. I don't pray myself. I've never been any good at it, even in my days as a nun. And I find my prayer, as it were, my main spiritual discipline is my study. I'm sitting right here at my desk right now, and I've put my books aside to talk to you. But sometimes when I'm absolutely involved in studying a sacred text very, very hard, I'll get moments of awe and wonder and delight, just mini seconds of that. Now, my Jewish colleagues tell me that's a very Jewish way of praying.
I was just going to say, that sounds like a very Jewish thing, getting it from the book, the Word.
Indeed. But also it's quite Christian. I think your last caller was talking about the religious life in the Catholic Church. Well, Benedictine monks used to spend some part of the day in what they call a divine study, where they immerse themselves in a text and get what they call mini seconds of oratio, or prayer, when your mind is suddenly lifted in wonder.
In your book, A History of God, you describe why different cultures experienced, or dare I say, created God or a sense of the divine in the way they did at different times and places. Do you think, for the most part, that God is culturally constructed?
Well, that's a very modern question, because before the modern period in the West, religion wasn't a separate activity. As we think of it now as something that's very spiritual, all about God and praying and your inner world, that has really, that it's cut off or separate from other activities of life. But in every culture, in the pre-modern world, and that includes the Christian Europe, religion permeated all activities indeed. So that politics, for example, was always seen as a sort of sacred activity, and all state ideologies were religious until the modern period. And so no other culture has this idea of religion as something sealed off mm-hmm. and separated. So trying to take religion out of culture, as it were, is a bit like trying to take the gin out of a cocktail.
So how do you see that, for example, if I may take a maybe controversial example, in the rise of conservative religion today, the Christian right in the U.S., the ultra-Orthodox among the Jews, and the radical Islamists? Do you see any common roots in today's global realities causing those?
I do. And part of this has been these radical movements you point out, as I explained in my book about the battle for God, have all arisen from a bruising conflict with secularism. All of them have been in some way damaged, if you like, or they feel attacked by a secularism that has been experienced or perceived as intrusive, invasive, and sometimes violent. In the Middle East, for example, secularist regimes such as those of Ataturk or the Shahs of Iran were extremely aggressive. On one occasion in 1935, for example, Shah Reza Pahlavi gave his soldiers orders to shoot at hundreds of unarmed demonstrators in one of the holiest shrines of Iran who were peacefully protesting against obligatory Western clothes. And hundreds of Iranians were killed that day. Now, in a context like this, where people have seen their clergy deprived of all their revenues or shot down and tortured or assassinated, secularism doesn't seem benign. And so in many parts of the world where a secular society on the Western model has established itself, a religious countercultural movement has grown up alongside it, feeling bruised and wounded and determined to push God and religion back to center stage. And history shows that whenever these movements are attacked, they almost invariably become more extreme, because that confirms them in their suspicion that religion really is out to destroy them, to destroy their faith. Even in the United States, for example, many Christians in small-town America felt, especially at the beginning of the 20th century, a very sort of violent time with its world wars, that they were being colonized by the secular ethos of Harvard or Yale or Washington, and developed this sort of more, as they said, fundamentalist forms of Christianity.
Karen Armstrong, scholar of religion, author of books including A History of God, The Battle for God, and A Case for God. And listeners, how do you think your concept of God reflects the circumstances of your life or the culture you live in today? Or how does your experience or practice of religion or perception reflect the circumstances of your life or the culture you live in today if you are a religious person? 212-433-WNYC, or spiritual, however you define it. And let's share some stories, thoughts, and feelings in relation to what Karen Armstrong is saying. I for this section of our family meeting on the Brian Lehrer Show on Passover and Easter, roughly defined, I would like to especially invite immigrants to call in. Immigrants from anywhere, how do you see your religion as a reflection of the condition of your life or the culture we live in? And how do you see the role of religion in the cultural setting you came from compared to how you see it here? That's the essential question. Immigrants from everywhere and immigrants from anywhere on this section of the show, the call-in is for you right now. How do you see the role of religion in the cultural setting you came from compared to how you see it here? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Did God get pictured differently in your country of origin? Did people pray differently in your country of origin and here? Do these differences in prayer and how people experience God or picture God reflect the different lives that people lead there and here? Will any immigrants do a little history of God crowdsourcing for us on this? How do you see the role of religion in the cultural setting you came from compared to how you see it here? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. So Karen Armstrong, while those calls are coming in, you talked about getting your sense of spiritual joy, if that's the right term, from your study. Is there an emotion that you most feel in connection with your spiritual life? Could you identify one?
Yes, there is, as you say, this sense of wonder and awe and delight. But also, I have to say, a sense of profound disquiet. Because most of the world religions begin with a perception that there's something very wrong with the world, that people are hungry, that people are suffering, that there's injustice in the world, there's an imbalance of power and wealth, people are lonely, sick, dying. The first noble truth of Buddhism is a religion, life is dukkha, it's suffering, awry, there's always something wrong. And in the Christian world, in the Western Christian world, you have an image of a man in an extremity of agony, an agony inflicted upon him by other human beings. And so I think this sense of disquiet, a sense that there's something wrong. The Prophet Muhammad said, not one of you can be a believer if he can sleep when he knows that somebody is hungry.
Mm.
And now we have this global vision of the world, and we see the suffering that's going on not only in our own society, but also worldwide. That was the impulse really behind my Charter for Compassion, that religions should rally to this call to try to assuage the suffering that we see around us. And in that... In that sort of reaching out to others, and we can't confine it. We're not allowed to confine it to our own group of people or our own cronies. We have to have, as one Chinese sage put it, Yan Ai, concern for everybody. Love the stranger, says Leviticus. Love your enemies, says Jesus. Reach out to all tribes and nations, says the Quran. And from that sense of outreach, there can come a sense of joy and a sense of freedom, really, as you leave your selfish, self-preoccupied state behind.
Joy and freedom from moral outrage and moral sleeplessness, according to Karen Armstrong, with who we will continue in a minute, in addition to your calls on this Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on Easter, Passover, and God. Stay with us. It's a Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on Easter, Passover, and God this morning. Our current guest, the religious scholar Karen Armstrong, author of books including A History of God, The Battle for God, and A Case for God. And let's take some calls from some of the immigrants among you to talk about whether you think God has a different meaning, religion has a different meaning, whether people pray differently or picture God differently in the country that you came from or the culture that you came from or the conditions that you came from compared to here. Let's try Gloria in Westchester to start this off. Hi, Gloria. You're on WNYC.
Hi. Adore your show.
Thank you.
Yes, I was raised in a country that was 95% Catholic. I am now a recovering Catholic. When the church told me that I couldn't use birth control, and when I stopped using birth control to go back for the absolution, so I never went back.
What country are you from originally?
Colombia.
And do you think that people in Colombia experience their Catholicism differently from the people you know here, even though you personally are lapsed?
Colombia is still very much a Catholic country, but as I came to the United States and began to study and read things that were not allowed for me to read in Colombia, even at the university, I realized that all the sacred texts were man-written, and therefore God became a man, and all they do is impose more rules and hardship.
And the same here as there, basically.
Yes.
Because my question is to ask you to compare the experience of Catholicism that you think people have in Colombia or people you knew in Colombia compared to what you see in the United States. Anything on that?
Well, the United States is much more ecumenical because the separation of church and state. Colombia didn't have a separation of church and state until 1992. So everybody was Catholic, and the bishops ran the country as they wanted to. And so definitely it's a yes. very different way of seeing the Catholic Church here or in Colombia.
Gloria, thank you so much.
Let's
try Yaya in the Bronx. Do I have your name right? Is it Yaya?
Yes, sir. You have my name right.
Thank you for calling. Where are you from originally?
I'm from Yemen in the Middle East.
So what would you like to compare?
I would like to compare the way my interaction with the society feels in Yemen and in the United States. So in Yemen, it's very much the same religion as Islam, and you don't experience any kind of diversity in religions. But when I came to the United States, there's different religions, there's different sects of religions. There's different churches, there's different mosques, Sunni and Shiite, and there's, you know, diversity. And the beautiful thing about this country is that de facto the government is supporting diversity, and no one can impose anything upon you.
Did it give you a different relationship with your, I'm assuming you're Muslim, once you came here, that you still identify, but your relationship to it changed?
Actually, my experience with Islam has increased when I came to the United States. The Muslim population in the United States is actually more religious than the populations in the Middle East. In the mosque, people are more dedicated to the mosque. People come and spare donations. People come, and Ramadan feels different in the United States than it feels in the Middle East.
Really? More devoted? Do you think that's a matter of the choice that people have here, as opposed to the obligation and only one way to do things that you were describing home in Yemen?
Yeah, I think people in the United States, because they miss where they're from and they live in a different society, they want to feel more connected with where they're from and their faith. And I find it surprising at first when I saw that people in here, my colleagues and my friends, are actually more practicing Muslims than the ones in Yemen. Like, we actually have, like, Friday seminars and Saturday seminars that I've benefited from more than I have learned in Yemen. So
yeah, thank you so much. And Karen Armstrong, that's an intriguing call, a counterintuitive call maybe, that Muslims here would be more observant than the ones in Yemen where he came from. And I think it relates to what you were describing earlier about how until the modern era, when we would look at things from the outside and ask ourselves if religion is culturally constructed, that it's so interwoven with the society, the more traditional society that he came from, that it takes on a different meaning. What were you thinking as you heard that call?
Well, it is quite common for immigrants to be more observant in their new country than they were at home. And also it gives people a sense of community, of familiarity, too, a sort of link with home, if you like. It's certainly also, I think, the case here in the UK. In the UK, we are a very secular country indeed. Only 6% of the population attend a religious service regularly here.
So much more secular than the United States.
Far, far more secular. It's always intriguing to me that when I come to the United States, I can talk to people very differently about religion than from here. I mean, I have friends who are sort of rather appalled that I managed to make a living out of writing about this discredited stuff about religion. But I think that a large proportion of that 6% of people who are observant in this country are Muslim. I think they've bumped up our national average considerably. So I think that is quite, it's not called counterintuitive, it's quite a common phenomenon.
Nicholas in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nicholas.
Hello, Brian. Thank you. I'm actually originally from Palestine, but I'm raised Greek Orthodox.
Uh-huh.
And I've been in this country quite a few years. You can feel the division where I was raised as a Greek Orthodox, and then I became a Baptist since I went to the school there, between the religions, between a Muslim, Christian, and Jewish, because it was under the Israeli government as well. Whereas when you come to this country, you don't feel that division between religions as much as you would feel when you are back home. And it's quite, unfortunately, it's not right for the people to be feeling this way, because they all, as people, should be more equal. But the mentality and the way they are raised, and then the Baptist community that I belong to, later on, when I came to America, I found out that it's more about money and really for the priest or the pastor that does preaching, that he actually collects the money to have a better financial situation for him and maybe have a Learjet that he spreads the words of God, whereas the rest of the people here really are not in that situation, but they give the money to them because they are followers.
So does this make you cynical about religion here, about even your religion here?
It does, because really I believe in myself. I believe that there is a God. You know, I don't know what form. It's a force that exists. I don't think it's a human, because it's a force. But I disregard the sections of religion, because it creates problems among people. And it creates problems as well in the world. And here we have, unfortunately, the racism problem, but religion is the base of the problems that we have in this world.
Nicholas, thank you very much. Marie in Queens, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Marie.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning, Miss Armstrong. Just to answer your question just briefly, I'm from the Caribbean, I'm from Haiti, and how we worship there differently, I want to say it's about the wealth of the country and our resources are limited. We're open to God in everything that we do. We bear our souls when we worship, so it's not superficial. Even in this country where you go to Haitian congregations, they pray much differently than we do, as English speakers. We
like
bear
how?
Our souls, we give everything.
Is it more ecstatic? Is it more loud?
No. I'm from a very conservative congregation. We're Seventh-day Adventist Sabbatarians.
Uh-huh.
We're less proud of, physical accomplishment and worldly things. We really focus on God and our relationship with Him. All the external and superficial college degrees, money, that is all set aside when we worship where I'm from. I don't know if it has to do with the situation of the country. Here in this country, I find that we're a little proud when we approach God.
Proud?
Yeah.
Too proud of us as individuals and
Correct.
Our egos?
Yes, too proud. Like, for example, I'm Brian Lehrer. I have a great show. You know, when I approach God, I'm not as a sinner. I don't approach Him as a sinner and that He creates me. He gives me this job. He gave me health this morning. So where I'm from, we go to the minute. We go to the very small detail of who God is to us as our creator, as the giver of life, pardoning our sins.
Yes.
You know, He will resurrect us again. We go to the detail, and it's an everyday thing. I find with English speakers in this country, we're a little, proud. I think that's the best word I can say.
Yeah, Marie, thank you. Thank you so much. So well put. Karen Armstrong, maybe a great example of religion being culturally constructed or the individual's relationship to it.
Yes, I think there's certainly a lot to be said for our very capitalist-driven societies where we do, where the whole emphasis is often on efficiency, progress, wealth. And also, you know, we are very sort of puffed up about ourselves in the Western world, I think, generally, you know. And it's ego. It's ego, selfishness, greed that your previous caller was saying about people just embezzling or sort of taking money from the congregations. It's that holds us back from the divine and from our best selves and from enlightenment. And the whole point about religion is to lose the self, to put the self to one side. And the best way of doing that is by concentrating on the other in compassion
and
putting another person in the center of your world.
And in the context of our culture, so much of that, I think, would be about losing the privilege. I was in D.C. over the weekend, and I saw the Martin Luther King Memorial for the first time. And one of the things that struck me about the quotes that were engraved there was his universalism. He was a Christian preacher, but he would say things about how we need to go beyond our own race, religion, tribe, and our connection to the world. I think the Easter and Passover stories can both connect us to the world or just connect us to our religious or cultural tribes. But what King was talking about from an American perspective, especially in the late 60s, the latter part of his life, when he got into anti-Vietnam War protesting, was, I think, to see the rest of the world through our lens of privilege as Americans, even Black Americans.
Yes, and it's a coincidence, Brian, because 2 weeks ago I was in Atlanta at Morehouse College, which is Martin Luther King's college, and we were celebrating. I was there for the anniversary of his death, and you're quite right about King. And I think that his experience, you see, of suffering, of marginalization, gave him, instead of using that experience of pain to inflict pain on other people, it gave him an insight into the pain and marginalization of people all over the world. And I think that is a huge example of what religion can do. It's to open our hearts to the suffering of others and work hard, as he did, for a better world, with that sense of disquiet that I was talking about earlier. And, of course, it reminds us that religion isn't all about having a nice, warm experience. It can be dangerous and risky. I mean, he, like Gandhi, lost his life, was killed. There's that religion is something that puts us on the edge, not to make us too comfortable in this world.
So in our last minute, do you see these holidays of Easter and Passover as making your compact for compassion either easier or harder to achieve?
Compassion is always something that's hard to achieve, but it's also something that human beings recognize in the core of their being as something that is not just a nice idea, but absolutely essential, I think, for the survival of our species, that we learn to treat all others, whoever they are, as we wish to be treated ourselves. If we don't do this, we're not going to have a viable world. Now, interestingly, some of the people who've come forward to help me most with the charter have not been religious people, but secular people. But I think we can all see at the heart of these religious celebrations the ideals of the religious life, the ideal of freedom, of liberation, of turning our backs, as it were, upon oppression, which is the story of the Passover. And Abelard, the great French philosopher, said that when we look at the agony of Jesus on the cross, our hearts break within us, and it is that act of compassion that saves us rather than just his sacrificial death.
Karen Armstrong, author of best-selling books on religion and founder of the Charter for Compassion, which you can see at charterforcompassion.org. Thank you so much. Happy Easter, happy Passover, happy life.
Happy Easter, happy Passover, and all the good wishes to you too, Brian.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and today and tomorrow, back-to-back family meetings on heaven and earth. Tomorrow, for Earth Day, it's Ask a Climatologist. No politics, just the actual science of climate change driven by your questions. But for today, for this Easter Monday and this last full day of Passover, let's continue our family meeting on Passover, Easter, and God. And let's talk about God, or spirit, or deity, an intelligence, a presence, a force. Maybe you heard Barbara Ehrenreich, an intellectual trained in science, an atheist to boot, on Fresh Air last week, talking about this experience she had as a teenager. Have you ever experienced anything like this?
There I was at an event, a boring, very boring event with my family, and something that my parents thought we could do on a Sunday afternoon together. And I was just, you know, staring at the woods. I didn't see anything very interesting about the horses. And then something happened. It's like a layer peeled off the world, the layer that contains all the meanings, the words, the language, the associations we have. So, yeah, I was looking at trees, but I no longer could say I knew exactly what a tree was with all the, you know, all the knowledge and experience that goes into our notion of a tree.
Barbara Ehrenreich, last week on Fresh Air, her new book is called Living with a Wild God. Listeners, have you ever had a wild God experience like that? Call in and share it and tell us what you think it meant. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. You ever have a moment like that? And what did Barbara Ehrenreich ultimately conclude that her experience meant?
The only words I can put to it after all these years are that the world flamed into life. Everything was alive. It was like there was a feeling of an encounter with something living, not something godlike, not something loving, not something benevolent, but something beyond any of those kinds of categories, beyond any human categories.
An experience beyond any human categories. Barbara Ehrenreich on Fresh Air. Ever been there, folks? If so, how did it affect your life, your understanding of who you are in the universe, your relationship to how you spend your time on Earth or relate to other people? If you're Christian or Jewish, does it make you think or feel a certain way about the mystical moments in the Easter and Passover stories? Or were you just temporarily insane when you went through this? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 on WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJO 90.3 Toms River, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJP 88.5 Sussex, New York and New Jersey Public Radio, our Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on Easter and Passover and God today. And let's start to flesh this out with none other than Krista Tippett, host of the weekly public radio show On Being, which we air here on the weekends. Hi, Krista. Happy Easter. Happy Passover. Thank you for breaking out of your network bubble and giving us some one-on-one time today.
Hi, Brian. I'm so glad to be with you. What a great way to spend an hour of radio.
Had you heard that Barbara Ehrenreich story before?
You know, I had.
Do you recognize it as something familiar?
Yeah, you know what? I mean, what she's describing is kind of a mystical experience. And there's a mystical tradition and strain, you know, in all the great traditions. But Christianity, for example, kind of consigned that to experts, to monks and nuns. I mean, so it's very interesting to hear her talk about it. I was thinking when I listened to it again just now of this Celtic notion that there are thin spaces and thin times when moments, when the way they describe it, the veil between heaven and earth seems to be worn thin, the veil between the temporal and the eternal touch. And I think that's an interesting and lovely way to describe what she's describing. And you're right. So many people have those experiences
and
put different words around them.
Our full, our board is full of callers, and we'll bring some people on with their own stories in a minute. But you used to call your show Speaking of Faith, and you changed it a few years ago to On Being. And in a way, those are very different concepts. What's the difference between faith and being as the starting point for talking about spirituality in our lives?
I think it's very relevant to this discussion here. I wanted, when I started Speaking of Faith, to open up imaginations about what this part of life is in its fullness. But we found that the word faith is troubling for people. And I think that in this culture, and partly because of the way religion is discussed in media, faith seems to be a matter of belief and kind of membership. And I'm interested in religion as it is lived, not as a compartment that we call faith, but, the experiential as much as the cerebral. And, I think I realized that that's what we were ending up talking about, and that that's, to me, where religion is vital, when it is a matter of who you are and how you live, as opposed to just what you believe or what positions you take on things.
So let me play you another Barbara Ehrenreich clip in which she dismisses the idea of faith or belief as irrelevant to her quest for understanding deeper truths. She asked the question, why believe?
Why believe when you can know? I mean, I don't believe in extraterrestrials. I am really curious. I want to find out. I'll say I don't believe in evolution. I'm more or less convinced by the evidence. But I would like to just put the whole idea of faith and belief away. Let's try to find out things. Look, and let me just say this about religions. The religions that fascinate me and, could possibly tempt me are not the ones that involve faith or belief. They're the ones that offer you the opportunity to know the spirit or deity. And these are religions, I think most readily of West African-derived religions, which involve ecstatic rituals where people actually apprehend the spirit or the god or whatever that they are invoking and that they are trying to contact. I have respect for that. But don't ask me to believe anything.
Barbara Ehrenreich on Fresh Air, eschewing belief, as in a way Krista Tippett did with changing the name of her show from Speaking of Faith to On Being. And also joining us now is Lisa Anderson, a theologian trained at the Union Theological Seminary, where she is working on her doctoral dissertation titled On Love, Liberation, and Original Sin, A Black Queer Meditation. She is also director of Women's Multifaith Education at Auburn Theological Seminary here in New York. Lisa Anderson, happy Easter. Happy Passover.
Thank you so much, Brian. I'm loving this conversation, I just have to tell you.
Where would you like to enter it?
Oh, I think I want to enter it where Barbara Ehrenreich talked about the question of belief or, sort of pushing it to the side. I think I would agree with her on some level. And I'll say this because of my own personal story. I grew up in Camden, New Jersey. And for anybody that knows anything about Camden, that is one of those environments where low expectations are the order of the day. I was a poor black child, found out later I'm a queer child, growing up in that situation. And the idea that I was supposed to have and be nothing was sort of implanted in the environment in which I lived.
Had no choice but to be nothing.
Exactly. And yet there was a little storefront Christian radio station around the corner from my house. It was called WKDN, The Sound of New Life. And it was, for all intents and purposes, I wasn't supposed to love this station because it was, an evangelical station with a very conservative political message. But the message that I got from going up in my little bathroom and turning on my transistor radio and listening to that station was that there is a God that is inclusive, there is a God that is loving, and that your life is not limited by circumstances. That wasn't about belief. That became a knowledge that inhabited my body. And so when Barbara talks about I eschew belief in favor of knowing, that experience of God there in Camden was a knowing experience that that thrills me and inspires my work now.
And that more abstract experience that she had at the horse show, mm-hmm. of seeing the world in flames in a good sense, if your theology is grounded in a social justice ministry, if that's the way to put it, is a story like that just mystical distraction, or can the two connect?
You know, I know enough about Barbara Ehrenreich's justice causes to know that those stories connect, because at the core of my faith tradition, God is a God of radical love and inclusion. And the full flourishing of all human beings is at the ground of that. And Barbara believes that, too. So I think that whatever gets us down going on that same path, that's we're in sync
you,
at
you
that level.
You believe in Barbara Ehrenreich's earnestness enough
yes.
to take that on faith.
Yes.
You don't need religion to be working for social justice. So why the connection for you? Why original sin mm-hmm. in the title of your Black Queer Meditation dissertation?
Well, you know, for me, let me tell you, I believe in this. You know, I said that inclusion was so important and radical love was so important. What I know from my experience is that those doctrines within the church, those teachings about sin, have been used to sort of break people's wholeness, break people's sense of wellness and the truth, the knowledge that God loves them. So my work is specifically geared to undercut that notion. All of us have sinned, and that all of us are broken in this life. But God's love and God's inclusion is meant to heal that for all. And so when I do this work on sin, it's to move away from this idea that sin resides on the bodies of people that in our culture we have decided to exclude, and then to use God as a weapon against others.
Krista, want to come back in here?
Yeah, I just want to say, and kind of I like to open things up to a long view. And, you know, there's something that happened in particular in Protestant Christianity, and that was influenced in Protestant Christianity responding to the Enlightenment, where religion, Western religion, got disembodied. And it disconnected this believing with this knowing. And I just think the way Barbara Ehrenreich said that is just beautiful. With, you know, the believing, the cerebral with the experiential. Religion across human history in all its forms forever was this cathartic, physical, emotional, spiritual, intellectual, all of those things, right? It used to be a place where we sang and danced and wept and, you know, knew each other physically as well as, in, you know, in terms of sharing a set of beliefs. And I think that this is something that's kind of being recovered. And that's partly what Lisa is describing. You know, the fastest growing face of Christianity globally is Pentecostal Christianity, which is, you know, one sociologist I spoke with talks about these as Main Street mystics. And in these traditions, there's very often an incredibly robust and passionate connection between this kind of mystical experience and a passion for social justice and an experience of God's love. And so, you know, there it is. But as I say, this is something old that I think we're making new again for a new century.
So let's hear from some of our Main Street mystic listeners who relate in some way to the Barbara Ehrenreich experience. Maria in Hoboken, you're on WNYC. Maria, thank you so much for calling in.
Hi, how are you, Brian?
Good, thank you. So what happened to you?
I was about 8 or 9 years old. This was in the Philippines. I grew up in that country.
Uh-huh.
And we would always have a once-a-year project where we would go to this small, I don't know if I could call it forest, well, anyway, a group of trees and a few hills and all that. So we would plant trees. So we would be grouped in 5 pupils in one group. So we actually finished early, so we started, you know, playing around, fooling around. We all got tired, and I decided to lay on the ground. It was a very grassy area, pretty thick grass. So when I closed my eyes and then I opened them again, it was so weird. I could still see it in my mind's eye. The color of the trees, they're like in sharp focus. And it freaked me out a little bit. And all I could say is it wasn't a voice, it wasn't a face, it wasn't an image, it was just a feeling or a presence that calmed me down. I breathed in deeply, and I actually enjoyed the experience. But what was so weird was the sound of my friends, my classmates, it seemed like they were so far away, or maybe I was far away.
And you were
but
only
I knew
eight...
I was still in the same location.
Yeah, and you were only 8 or 9. Did this
yes.
change your life or your outlook on life going
well,
forward
I'll
in any way?
Well, I'll tell you what. Every time I feel some anxiety or I feel stressful, I'm 48 years old now. I sit down by myself, I close my eyes, and I could actually conjure up that experience. Mm-hmm. It's like it happened to me just yesterday.
Did it have any moral content, or was it just about colors and calmness?
Now that I'm much older, I look back on it, and the best way I could describe it to you is like I felt like I was in the palm of God's hand. Like he was rocking me to sleep or something like that. Very comforting feeling. That's why I always go back to it when I find myself stressful or when I'm trying to deal with a problem that I can't really like resolve or anything. Mm-hmm. But it's a reassuring feeling.
And it's there with you 40 years later. Maria, thank you so much. Katie in Summit, you have a story. Hi, Katie.
Hi. I do. I have a sort of mystical, mysterious story that happened to me in my late 20s at a time when I was sort of at a change in my life, sort of a crisis. But I had an experience that I would describe as plunging me, it only lasted probably 15, 30 seconds, plunging me into reality with the realization that where we are now is not reality. I remember thinking at the time, not thinking, knowing this event, was absolutely real. And I remember thinking, my God, you could have a gun to your head and you are in no danger. The best sort of analogy I've heard is, and it's a little prosaic, but it's as if you were all of a sudden looked up and realized you had been playing a video game where you had long since forgotten that the video game wasn't real, and you looked up and remembered, oh, that's right, I'm here. It was like that.
And what did it mean to you? What has it meant to you since, other than just this physical, surreal experience?
Let me just say, it wasn't surreal. What really marked it was more real than what we call reality, and uh-huh. how one could possibly describe realness, I don't have a chance. But what it did was, I'm a real scientist at heart, and for many years it lay dormant. For many years it was just this peculiar experience that I really didn't talk about much. And then later in life, I'm 55 now, so, you know, God, 20 years later, it became the door through which I could walk into some wonderful metaphysical stuff that I study. But I would never have been able, this metaphysical stuff I read, I would have laughed at had I not had this experience. It really just, it is the, you know, the linchpin on which all this other stuff would eventually hang.
What do you get for metaphysics? Is it primarily intellectual? Is it emotional? Is it moral?
It is, having this sort of scientist's heart, I have come into some really, everything has to sort of come to me in scientific terms. So I get the understanding of consciousness, and through that I am freed to be calm, kind. As my understanding of how the universe, the multi-layered universe works, it calms me, and that frees me into kindness.
Thank you so much, Katie. I really appreciate it. Lisa, you're nodding and...
Well, it was just what she said was very interesting to me, especially her focus on the scientific, because I was thinking to myself, ooh, I'm like the opposite of the scientist. What I get from my faith is this sense of an intimacy with God, that there is, at, you know, God is certainly, in my view, transcendent, meaning I am not God, we are not God. But when I talk about the radical, loving, and inclusive core of God, that comes from a personal experience of knowing a sense of God's beloving towards me and towards others. And then the action becomes, how do I manifest that in the world, not just for myself, but especially for others who've been cut off from that, so that they can experience that as well.
So the questions that I've been asking callers and guests throughout the show. How do you picture God, and what happens when you pray?
So I loved when Karen said it was not a physical presence, because God is not a physical presence to me, but God is presence. And so when I pray and when I meditate, there is a sense of calmness. It's interesting. It's like a calm urgency. It's like at the core of my being, this notion, this idea, this refrain over and over again, you are my beloved, you are my beloved, you are my beloved, envelops me in prayer and meditation. And the urgency that comes from that is, it's not yours alone. You need a community. I embrace a community of beloving. It's all of us. And so that's why it's urgent and it's calming at the same time.
Krista Tippett, how would you answer that question for yourself?
Really? Do you want me?
If you pray, maybe you don't pray per se, well, or you don't have to.
I absolutely do pray. I guess what I wanted to say, what I'm thinking about here as I listen, is I just think it's really important to state clearly that mystery, that a sense of mystery, a perception of mystery, is a common human experience. And you don't have to be religious to understand this as part of life, right? I mean, the stories you're drawing out this hour are, you know, you might say they're on the extreme spectrum. I don't know. But maybe we all have these experiences. We don't talk about them. I also, though, want to say that I interview a lot of scientists, and scientists have an incredibly robust vocabulary of mystery and wonder. And I do think that's connected to curiosity, which I think is a spiritual virtue. And again, I think something that we kind of lost in this culture was an ability to just honor this part of human life and be articulate about it and honor it alongside our intellectual pursuits. You know, I love the language of Einstein. That's actually very helpful for me, kind of to answer your question, Brian, in terms of how I think about God. You know, mm-hmm. Einstein was not a traditionally religious person. He didn't believe in a personal God, but he would use language like that. You know, his sense of an intelligence behind the universe, the mind behind the universe, a superior spirit behind the cosmos, and that's very resonant language for me these days.
We'll continue in a minute with our Brian Lehr Show family meeting on Easter and Passover and God. We've still got three great guests to roll into this conversation and more of your calls. Stay tuned.
Without you, there's no me or the air that I breathe. Sometimes the world is dark and I just can't see. With these demons around, all around, bring me down to negative fatigue. But I believe, yes, I believe, I said I believe. Feeling my love will be holy and ceiling. I give myself to you from the essence of my being, and I sing to my God. Songs of love and healing, I want Mashiach now.
It's the Brian Lehr Show on WNYC. 2 days of family meetings back to back. Tomorrow for Earth Day, a family meeting on Earth, but it's family meetings on heaven and earth today and tomorrow. Today, our family meeting on Passover and Easter and God. We have Lisa Anderson with us, Director of Women's Multifaith Education at Auburn Theological Seminary, and Krista Tippett, host of the public radio program On Being. And also joining us now, Mark Epstein, known to some of you as a Manhattan psychotherapist and author of books including The Trauma of Everyday Life, published last year, and Going On Being, Life at the Crossroads of Buddhism and Psychotherapy. Mark Epstein, welcome back to WNYC.
Okay, thanks a lot, Brian.
And there's that phrase again, on being. It's what Krista Tippett calls her radio show, and your book about being a Buddhist psychotherapist is Going on Being. What does your title mean to you?
Well, there's a famous statement from a hero of mine, a British psychoanalyst named W.R. Beon, who said it's impossible to know reality for the same reason that makes it impossible to sing potatoes. They may be grown or pulled or eaten, but not sung. Reality has to be being. There should be a transitive verb to be expressly for use with the term reality. So going on being, that's the spiritual, you know. We tune into a different way of experiencing whatever we think of as reality, and we have that sense that your caller before from the Philippines talked about of, you know, being rocked by God and the world being alive in a way that most of the time our self-preserving egos obscure that reality for us.
So is psychotherapy different from a Buddhist perspective than it might be from a Jewish or Christian or Muslim or Hindu one? Or is your religion your religion and the tools of psychotherapy are the tools of psychotherapy?
Well, I always liked Buddhism because I thought of it as the most psychological of the world's religions and the most spiritual of the world's psychologies. But what I got from Buddhism was really permission just to be myself. And I try to bring that to the practice of psychotherapy. I don't speak Buddhist language in particular. I just try to find the truth of whatever someone needs to be seeing me for.
Krista, any reactions or questions for fellow on being person?
I think that some of the things that Mark is describing is why Buddhism has just kind of come into 21st century lives and been so welcomed. It does have a psychology, a very sophisticated psychology, and a sophisticated sense of our minds and attention. And in a way, you know, I said earlier on that you know, Christianity and Judaism, you know, they have these deep contemplative traditions, but they kind of handed them off to experts. And Buddhism, in its way, for these thousands of years, has been cultivating this capacity of any person to be present to themselves and to know the inner workings of their mind and how that infuses their presence in the world with an incredible sophistication. And people are just picking that up with such eagerness now.
Yeah.
And it really converges with what we're learning in neuroscience. You know, it's kind of an amazing, beautiful convergence.
And so, Mark, thinking about the Barbara Ehrenreich clips about her mystical vision, I once had a therapist who was more informally into Eastern religions than I think you are, but she used to do both conventional psychotherapy and encourage her clients to seek these ecstatic experiences through breathing exercises and things like that, because she believed therapy wasn't just for exploring your problems, but also for maximizing your inner life potential, you know, not just reducing your happiness deficit, but taking your inner life way into positive territory. Is that like anything you do?
Well, I'm actually not so oriented towards the ecstatic experiences, although I think they come unbidden when you get yourself out of the way, you know. I'm more interested in helping my patients not make the suffering that is intrinsic to their lives, not make it worse than it already is. I think that's what I've really learned from Buddhism, is that how we think about things really conditions how we experience them, and what we have control over is how we think. And it's possible to work with our minds in a way that allows us to suffer less than we do when we're just letting our minds take control of things.
Listeners, what would you like to add or ask here? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Lisa Anderson, what were you thinking?
I was thinking about a group of women that I work with, African-American women in this group that I run through Auburn Seminary called the Sojourner Truth Leadership Circle. And the work that we do there is about aligning the values of self-care and self-love with their work in activist leadership. And that requires them to actually move past in collectivity and also singularly these spaces where they have been traumatized in their lives, and to engage in practices that actually help them to realize that the work that they're trying to do in the world includes them, and that the wholeness and wellness of their bodies, minds, and spirits is important. So it feels connected.
And also joining us now is Gadadhara Pandit Dasa, the first Hindu chaplain at Columbia University, NYU, and the Union Theological Seminary. Among other things, he teaches courses combining the themes of Hindu texts with popular Hollywood movies, and is author of the book Urban Monk, Exploring Karma, Consciousness, and the Divine. Gadadhara, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Happy to be here.
And I see you wrote a piece last fall on Huffington Post with the question headline, "Do we all worship the same God?" And your first line was, "I would like to think so." Why would you like to think that, and how do you think so as a Hindu around Passover and Easter?
Well, a lot of the teachings, not all the teachings, of course, a lot of the teachings of the different traditions do encourage loving one another, loving our neighbors, becoming more compassionate, becoming more humble. Seems to be a certain thread that's similar and makes you think it's got to be the same person up there that's sharing this message. That's, of course, there's some minor adjustments made. Of course, we believe in reincarnation. A lot of other traditions don't. But I just don't think that there's a Hindu heaven, there's a Jewish heaven, there's a Muslim heaven, there's a Christian heaven. I kind of feel like we're all going to go to the same place. And if there were many gods for each tradition, then I don't know, that might create competition even in the spiritual realm, which would not make it so much different than down here.
The Greeks had many gods even within their tradition.
Yeah, and Hinduism has a lot of gods too, but a lot of Hindus, especially the Bhagavad Gita, one of the primary texts of Hinduism, suggests that Hinduism is monotheistic. Of course, according to the Bhagavad Gita, that supreme deity is Krishna, which is known as all attractive, all beautiful. So there is one primary deity, and all the other deities are considered to be, for example, managing the universe, just like in a government of a country. You've got millions of employees running the government, running the country in every aspect of it. So there are so many deities running the universe, taking care of the sun, the moon, the wind, the earth, the lakes, the oceans. But they're not all supreme.
And so let me play one more clip of New York Cardinal Timothy Dolan on Face the Nation yesterday, and you might relate to this, talking about Easter and introspection and changing the world.
Whenever you talk about change, reform, transformation, which are big words, which Jesus often talked about, first and foremost, we're always talking about what? Inside in the human heart. Conversion of life. Going from selfishness to selflessness, going from sin to grace, going from hate to love, going from bitterness to forgiveness. That's the kind of change, conversion, transformation that is at the heart of the Christian message. Now, you've heard Pope Francis say that. He says, first and foremost, I got to change myself, and then I got to call all of you to the kind of authentic change, the invitation to conversion of heart that it's at the core of the message of Jesus.
So, Lisa Anderson, it doesn't matter whether you believe in Jesus or the multiple deities under Krishna or whatever?
I actually think that's true. Isn't that interesting? That's not the Christianity that I was hearing on the fundamentalist radio station. But
when you were a kid,
when
in
I was
Camden.
A kid in Camden, no, it was not. But I actually do believe it's true. I think God, that love that I was talking about. God loves the difference that God has made. So in my Christian expression, it is a monotheistic expression. But that I would not know what these mysteries of the universe contain, and if they would be more than the singular that I ascribe to. I'm willing to be open to being proved wrong, because wrong is not the right or wrong is not the value.
Ryan in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ryan.
Hi, first long time listener and a big fan, but first time caller.
Thank you.
I'm a clinical psychologist, and I guess similar to your therapist, I've used mindfulness not just to decrease distress, but to see that when people become more aware of their inner workings, they are able to bolster happiness. And I was just wondering if The guests would like to speak about how mindfulness practice might help through awareness people to increase their happiness and other positive attributes.
Mark Epstein, as the Buddhist psychotherapist on the panel, I think that's for you.
Yeah, sure. Well, I first want to say I think it's wonderful that you're having this discussion right after the death of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, because he was so wonderfully expressive of the magical undercurrents of life. That's something that when we practice mindfulness, what mindfulness does, mindfulness is just awareness of what your mind is doing in the moment, and it lets you see the self-preoccupation that's like a scrim, like a screen, that gets in the way of the experience of the other person or of your life or of your feelings. And when you get that self-preoccupation out of the way, there's an underlying movement towards happiness, movement towards calmness, movement toward understanding that can emerge from the mind.
And so on that note, at least a little, let me play one more Barbara Ehrenreich clip from Fresh Air on her book Living with a Wild God, in which she discussed that mystical experience she had as a teenager, seeing the world as being in flames, as she described it, but in a beautiful way that made her think there was some level of reality beyond our usual one. The exploration she began after that included turning to one set of Hindu texts.
One of the things I got my hands on was a copy of the Upanishads, I hope I'm saying that right, which is a very abstract book. I knew nothing about the pantheon of Hindu deities, nothing. I knew nothing about Hindu rituals or pujas. I just had this book that talked very abstractly about the nature of reality, the underlying reality. And I was very excited. Somebody else had thought some things somewhere that were not too different from what I was thinking.
Huh. So, Gadadhara Pandit Dasa, did she say Upanishads right?
Yes. And, you know, I'd like to share a similar experience that I had. It was about 20 years ago. I had just read the Bhagavad Gita, in which in the 8 chapters explained that the world that we live in isn't completely real. Like, it's also kind of a theme from the movie The Matrix, and that there's a higher reality out there, and that we are not our physical material bodies. We're actually trapped in these bodies, and our home is in the spiritual realm. And I remember after reading that, I was actually in East Europe at that time. I kind of stood, I was standing in this shopping area. I was looking at people walking by. I was just thinking that, is it possible that everybody here is no one here is really aware of this? And is it possible that I'm living in a false reality? So the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita, yeah, do talk about this idea that of an alternate, a spiritual reality where time does not destroy the things around you. Time is an instrument in this world that deteriorates things and then separates you from the things that you care for and love. And this time exists in the spiritual realm. It allows sequence of events to take place, but it doesn't separate you from the things and the people that you love.
How could thinking that you may not be living in the real reality, but only in an illusion, not separate you from connectedness? How could it connect you rather than disconnect you?
Well, the whole idea is through meditation and prayer, we're in the process of reconnecting with that reality. You know, so even the bodies that we live in, we know that they're temporary. Using the body in acts of service, using the body to try and love one another, to love God, we are trying to reconnect to that reality. And so, you know, temporarily, you know, at one point when we chose to leave the spiritual realm and come to the material realm, the choice that we made, now it's an opportunity for us to, again, have that union mm-hmm. with the divine, with God, again, through acts of devotion, prayer, meditation. And it gives us an opportunity every day at every moment to actually to try and connect with that divine reality.
Cheshire in Queens. You're on WNYC. Hi, Cheshire.
Hi, Brian and everybody. I'm calling because I'm a Quaker, and Quakerism is a religion of direct mystical experience, not of doctrinal statement or dogma. When you go into Quaker worship, the idea is to have a direct experience of the divine, both transcendent and immanent, beyond and within. And it's also a communal mystical experience. It's a kind of three-part communion, not just between the worshiper and the divine, but between the whole worshiping community and the divine, and consequently of all of the worshipers within the community.
What do you do during Easter and Passover as a Quaker?
As a Quaker, nothing, because Quakers don't observe holidays. Every day is holy. Every day is consecrated to God. One of the insights I had this year about what that means is, you know, Easter, Passover, even Christmas, if you think about it, they're very much about passages from one spiritual state to another, from one condition to another. And all of life is, if you think about it, it's about birth, growth, dying away, birth, growth, dying away. So there's a sense in which saying there are no holidays can mean there are all the holidays. And how do you hold the message of all those holidays within you every day?
And we're going to... That's so so interestingly put, and so sets up our next guest, Father James Martin, that we are going to end this segment here. And thank you, Cheshire, for putting such a great cap on it. And thank all our guests, Mark Epstein, Gadadhara Pandit Dasa, Lisa Anderson, Krista Tippett. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
As
thank
our you, Brian. Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on Easter, Passover, and God continues with Father James Martin in just a minute, who some of you may know as Stephen Colbert's priest. I wonder if he will be moving his act from Comedy Central to CBS. Stay with us. We have gone from Kanye West all the way to Bach with our musical selections on this Easter Monday and last full day of Passover family meeting on Passover, Easter, and God on The Brian Lehrer Show today. And our final guest is Father James Martin, Jesuit priest, editor-at-large for the Catholic magazine America, sometimes known as Stephen Colbert's priest. We'll see if that enterprise moves to CBS. And author of books, including A Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything and his new one, Jesus, A Pilgrimage. Father Martin, happy Easter and welcome back to WNYC.
My pleasure.
So we've been talking about the meaning of religious experience in the concrete world. And you begin your book with a reflection on how to understand Jesus as both fully human and fully divine, flowing from the Gospel of Mark, in which Jesus asks, "Who do people say that I am?" But why should we care about that description? He could be a very wise teacher, or he could be a god. He could be 60-40, 30-70. Why even bother with that?
Well, you know, I always say to people that someone who does miracles and stills storms and heals the sick and particularly rises from the dead is someone to pay attention to. And so the idea of his divinity, and particularly, you know, here on Easter Monday, his resurrection, really lends credence to what he says and what he did.
So here's a clip of all people, former President Jimmy Carter on this show a few years ago from a conversation we had about religion when he actually published a book of commentaries on the Bible or the New Testament. I asked him if he believes literally in the supernatural story of the resurrection on Easter. Do you believe literally in the sacrificial death and resurrection of Jesus?
Yes, I do. That's a fundamental belief of almost all Christians, I think all the Christians that I know, Catholics, Protestants of all kinds, and so forth, that we are saved by the grace of God through our faith in Jesus Christ. And I have that personal assurance, that personal belief, yes.
The resurrection is pretty mystical, metaphysical thing.
Well, Paul wrote, we don't know how that is. It's just like you see a butterfly that looks like a worm, and all of a sudden it transforms into a beautiful, ornate thing like a flower. And he describes that our life now is kind of like a seed that's planted, like a seed peanut, which I grow. And you plant the peanut, which is a little tiny thing, and everybody eats them when they're parched or cooked. But then it grows into a beautiful flowering plant that has yellow blossoms and almost miraculous in its complexity. So we don't have any way to understand what's going to happen in the future. And Jesus said that we wouldn't. We wouldn't know when that's going to come. We wouldn't know what the characterization would be. But we have faith in that, and I think that whether we have faith in all the miracles of Christ described in the Bible or not, we can certainly adopt the teachings of Jesus as a perfect example of how a human being should live.
Former President Jimmy Carter on the show a few years ago. Father Martin, is your belief like his about this? Because you do write in your book that miracles are an essential part of the Jesus story.
They are. I would say I agree with President Carter, basically. And without the miracles, the gospel stories pretty much fall apart. One of the points I make in my book is that the miracle stories undergird a lot of his teachings that other people take for granted. People take for granted certain teachings that Jesus has that are accompanied by miracles. And frequently, if you take out the miracle stories, the context for those teachings just falls apart. So the answer is yes.
That must be some job for cardinals, being the miracle umpires, because doesn't a candidate for Catholic sainthood, and I think two recent popes are up right now, need to be credited with three miracles apiece?
Actually, two. They're different kinds.
Two.
Yeah,
sorry.
They're different kinds
of miracles.
I don't
want to make it any harder than it is.
Yeah, the bar is already pretty high. Yeah, it's to be clear, it's Catholics believe that you pray to the person in heaven who prays to God. So that's it's God who does the miracles. But Jesus's miracles, I think, are on a different order. I mean, they're quite dramatic.
So the question we've been asking people throughout the show: what happens when you pray to God?
That's a great question. I'm a Jesuit, and one of the ways that Jesuits like to pray, and we've been finding this out from Pope Francis, is to imagine yourself in a scripture scene, and I talk about that in the book a lot. And so frequently I pray by imagining myself in a gospel scene, but sometimes I just pray by just placing myself in God's presence and doing what's called centering prayer. So a lot of the same techniques that your guests are talking about.
And let me linger on this, sure, this idea that you just put out there about putting yourself in the scene, because I found that a fascinating part of your book. You call it a marvelous way of praying, popularized by the 16th century founder of the Jesuits, St. Ignatius Loyola, and one of its names is imaginative prayer. So describe it a little more for our listeners, would
yeah.
you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, basically, if you're talking about a miracle story, let's say Christ stilling a storm, you would imagine yourself in the boat with the disciples, and you would say to yourself, trusting that God's at work through your imagination, what do you see? You know, what does the boat look like? What do the disciples look like? What do you hear? The waves? What do you feel? What do you smell? What do you taste? You know, which is not a big thing for this passage, but for something like the miracle of the loaves and the fishes. And you kind of let the scene play out, and you see what comes up, what emotions, what desires, what memories, basically what is God trying to tell me through this passage? And the point is to trust that God can work through your imagination, and you can kind of appropriate it in a new way. And that's a very popular way to pray among Jesuits.
So listeners, anybody engaged in imaginative prayer out there, you want to tell your imaginative prayer screenplays, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or anything else for Father James Martin, author now of Jesus, A Pilgrimage, 212-433-9692, on this last full day of Passover, this Easter Monday. Family meeting on Easter, Passover, and God here on The Brian Lehrer Show, 212-433-9692. Can you give us an example of yourself doing that? Like, you wrote that some parts of Jesus' life lend themselves especially well to imaginative prayer, like when he heals the sick. So maybe you can share one of your imaginative prayers as a little like spiritual improv.
Yeah, sure. No problem. I mean, it's easy to do. There's a passage called The Rejection at Nazareth, you know, where Jesus is preaching in his hometown, and he gets up and he basically says, "I'm the fulfillment of Scripture." And people reject him, and they, according to the Gospels, drive him to the brow of a hill where they're going to throw him, you know, off the cliff. And when I was praying that one day on retreat, it dawned on me that not only did the people know Jesus, but that he knew them. You know, he was in his hometown in Nazareth. And it dawned on me that he was free, you know, of the need to be approved or to be liked by the people in his hometown. He said what he needed to say. And so it was an insight for me into the life of Jesus. And I felt a kind of, you know, a way that God was kind of communicating to me this message of, you know, be free of the need to be liked. And so those are the kinds of things that, that come up. It's a connection with the from the you know, the gospel passage to your own life, you know, I believe inspired by God.
Jim in Brick Township, you're on WNYC. Hello, Jim.
Oh, hi. I'm looking at the Google for the Jewish services of the Mincha, the philosophy of prayer, quotes that the Jewish philosophy and in rabbinic literature, it is noted that the Hebrew verb for prayer, hitpalal, is in fact the reflexive form of palal, to judge. Thus, to pray conveys the notion of judging oneself. Ultimately, the purpose of prayer, tefillah, is to transform ourselves.
Nice. Thank you. You're
That's
late
interesting.
To that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but C.S. Lewis once said, the great, you know, English Christian scholar, said, you know, I don't pray to change God, but to change myself. You know, I think the point of prayer is to be in relationship with God. That's how I see it.
I like that. So it's sort of the Talmud according to Google there.
Yeah, by that's right.
Jim from Brick. Steve in Rutherford, you're on WNYC. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I love your show. Both sons going to Jesuit high schools. Mm-hmm. Love Jesuits. I use that prayer philosophy. And in motorcycling, there's a technique called target fixation. So if I look at the bump in the road, I will hit the bump in the road. So what I have to do is look at the clear path around the bump, and that's where I go. And I have always, and I'm 57 now, I've always, all my life, looked at where I wanted to go and know I was going to get there. And that's my prayer. You know, God, please give me the wisdom, the strength, and the vision to do your will.
Thank you very much. And if the earlier caller was talking about prayer as judgment, self-judgment, I think Lorraine in Bergen County has another way to come at prayer. Lorraine, you're on WNYC.
Good morning, gentlemen. It always confuses me. What is prayer? Prayer to me is praise, but prayer to me is not asking for anything. Only, and like the gentleman before me said, he looks within from within himself. And that's what I do. I look from within myself if I'm at a hurdle or you know, not an easy place in my life.
So when you say it's not a request, you don't pray for answers?
I don't pray for answers. To me, God gave me everything that I have, and I'm very grateful for that. And I don't expect anything more. I don't believe in a personal God. I don't believe that there's a God, standing over me. I don't believe that I can pray to God for anything.
Mm-hmm. Lorraine, thank you. Father Martin, how do you relate to that? And I don't mean, you know, praying for trivial things, like give me a new Maserati, but people pray for things all the time. People pray for their mother's cancer to get healed. On and on.
They do, and so do I. It's natural. It's human. It's part of being in relationship with God. I mean, you know, one thing Jesus says, you know, in the Our Father, give us this day our daily bread, and that's an asking prayer. That's a request. I think that prayer, as I said, is about a relationship, and sometimes, you know, in a relationship we feel that we need something, and I think you can't not ask God for things. I think it's just part of our human nature, and I ask for things all the time.
You also write in your book about a practice called faith sharing that you do on Sunday evenings with some of your fellow Jesuits, and you describe it first as discussing how God has been active in your prayer that week and your daily lives over the last week. What does that mean, how God has been active in your prayer? Can you describe how God is active rather than a passive recipient of prayer in the way that was just being discussed?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, some of the things that I was describing in terms of imaginative prayer, but even something as simple as the other day I was praying, I was very stressed out, and I just decided I'm going to be in God's presence, and I imagine myself back in Galilee. I was in the Holy Land a couple of years ago, and I felt this great sense of calm. And I connected that to God's just giving me a sense of calm. So those are the kinds of things you would talk about. And then in your daily life as well, where have you noticed God's presence?
Tegan in Pearl River, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Tegan.
Yes, good morning. I would just have to add, as far as imaginative prayer goes, I feel like I spent enough hours and days of my life in church listening to the scripture and in some Bible studies, studying the Word of God and getting to know the stories. And once you have a feeling for those stories, you get a feel for who Jesus was. And in my life, especially like I told the screener, I grew up during the time of the What Would Jesus Do bracelets. And I think that really became an integrated part of who I was, that as I walk through my life, as I meet a person in need or a situation that needs some help, I'm like, well, what would Jesus do? You know, would he be sitting around studying the old scriptures and picking apart every little Bible verse, or would he like roll up his sleeves and get down there and start doing the work to build the world that we want to, you know, the kingdom come, you know? And so I feel like that's how I use imaginative prayer, and it's how I teach my children to relate to Jesus. It's not studying every little move he made. It's walking like Jesus would walk and talking like Jesus would walk and doing the types of service to others and service to the world and the environment that Jesus would do.
Well said. And since that's such an everyday thing for you, does something special happen for you at Easter time?
Well, it's kind of hurtful for me at Easter time, actually. I was sitting in church yesterday, and there's all this focus on the sacrifice and the death and the sacrifice for our sins. And for me, I love to focus on, you know, what did Jesus do with the 34 years that he had on this earth? And how did he, like, take action? And how did he, like, you know, just have nonstop, you know, activism, really, for me, is how I see it. And I like to really focus on that transcendence to the next realm, and that he came alive again. And the fact that he was resurrected is what I focus on. And I just feel like it's just kind of like God reaching out to us and being like, look, pay attention, you know, knock, knock, knock. It's time that, like, if you can't pay attention to all the good deeds and the wonderful way that Jesus just was and existed in among you,
I see
then
that.
At least, like, if I do this big sacrifice, maybe you'll pay attention, you know?
I see
I just look at the new life that came from him. And that's just to show that, like, he could transcend it all.
Thank you. I see the face of impressed approval on Father Martin.
Yeah, because a couple things. I think it's a both and. I think we do have to study, what Jesus said and did in order to help us understand what he would do, right? I mean, you have to understand the Gospels before we can say, or what would he do in this situation? I think that WWJD is actually, you know, a pretty good start. And I agree that you can't minimize the passion and the crucifixion and the pain, but I do think that there's an overemphasis sometimes on that one week of Jesus' life, you know, as opposed to the rest of his time in ministry, and in particular, as opposed to the resurrection.
But I saw that article about Easter that you wrote for Slate a few years ago that they republished last week, with the message that, unlike Christmas, which could be commercialized and dumbed down, there's no getting around the brutality of the Easter story.
Yeah, and I mean, we saw how powerful Mel Gibson's film was. I mean, not everybody liked it, but I mean, it really reminded us of the brutality of the crucifixion. And also, the resurrection is something that, you really have to grapple with. It's very hard to commercialize that. Either you believe in it or you don't. It's very hard to kind of make it into a kind of a commercial, secular, kind of silly story. Although the other day I saw Hop, by the way, with my two nephews. And there was not a mention of Jesus in the whole movie. In fact, funny enough, the main Easter Bunny says that we've been doing this for 4,000 years, which I kind of thought was amusing.
And just to put a little cap on the whole morning, this family meeting on Easter, Passover, and God, you are sometimes referred to as Colbert's priest in moments like this.
Jesus said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Mm-hmm. They've got everything. We rich people only have our stuff. Do you realize what an empty reward that is? It does nothing for me. Meanwhile, the poor people know what it's like to be close to God.
This is why.
What would I give to be poor other than my money?
That's the point. I mean, Christ invites you into simple living and also to help to the poor as a way to participate in that reign of God. And so it's an invitation. It's not a command or a directive. It's an invitation to love the poor and be with the poor, and therefore be with the people that Jesus loves the most.
All right. You on Colbert, I don't know on what day or what year, but are you moving this act to CBS Late Show with him?
If he invites me, I will go.
Can you imagine Stephen Colbert out of character, if he's not a fake, obnoxious right-wing talk show host? What kind of a conversation are you going to have?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I was thinking that he might actually, who knows, be even more open with his faith on The Late Show, you know, because he's not in character. And, you know, as you know, these late-night shows talk a lot about their own personal lives. So, you know, we'll see.
Father James Martin, his new book is Jesus, A Pilgrimage. Thank you so much and happy Easter to you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Back-to-back family meetings on Heaven and Earth on The Brian Lehrer Show. That wraps up our last full day of Passover. Monday, Easter Monday, family meeting on Passover, Easter, and God. Tomorrow, our family meeting on Earth for Earth Day. Global warming with no politics, just science. Talk to you then. Yeah, God.